Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Christian Science Monitor Daily program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading the stories from the Friday, January 9th, 2026 edition. So I hope you enjoyed the program. I'll begin, as usual, with the introduction by Linda Feldman, the Washington Bureau Chief. Renee Nicole Good was an American poet, activist, and mother of three. Her shooting death on Wednesday in Minneapolis at the hand of a U.S. immigration officer casts, in sharp relief, the challenge of maintaining order when emotions are high and weapons are present. In a report from the scene, today's monitor addresses a core question: when is or isn't the use of lethal force justified in immigration enforcement? Videos of the incident from multiple angles have played countless times on TV and are viewable online. For now, the key task is to establish the facts. The first article today is titled ICE Policy Limits Use of Lethal Force. Minnesota Shooting Tests Those Constraints, by Simon Montlake, Sarah Matusek, Caitlin Babcock, and Sophie Hills, all staff writers for the Monitor. The killing of a woman by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent in Minneapolis on Wednesday has reignited a national debate over the appropriate use of force by federal agents in carrying out immigration raids. Renee Good, a mother of three who had recently moved to the city, was fatally shot while in her car, which had been partially obstructing federal officers' vehicles. Administration officials said the officer acted in self-defense and sought to blame Ms. Good for the tragedy. Videos of the incident show an officer standing in front of Ms. Good's SUV, firing multiple shots as she began to drive her car away from the scene, as she had been reportedly ordered to do so by other agents. The car then plowed into a stationary vehicle and a utility pole on the snow-lined street. On Thursday, a few hundred people gathered in bitter cold at the scene. Clergy members spoke at the memorial site. Flowers, candles, and a cross that had spread across a sidewalk. She was not armed. She was not a threat. She was standing for freedom, says Janae Bates Emery, a minister and co-director of a faith-based nonprofit. And the federal government answered her courage with a bullet. "Murder," someone cried out from the crowd. "Murder, murder," others yelled. Ms. Good's shooting came after a year of aggressive immigration actions organized by the Trump administration, often in Democratic-run cities. The rapid expansion of ICE and increased use of other federal agencies to detain unauthorized immigrants have raised questions about the rules that govern their operations and whether the administration has ignored them in its pursuit of deportations after millions entered the United States during Joe Biden's presidency. Ms. Good is among several people physically harmed during ICE operations, including a deadly shooting in Chicago. On Thursday, two people were shot and wounded in Portland, Oregon, during a vehicle stop by U.S. Border Patrol agents. The Department of Homeland Security said the agents were trying to apprehend an unauthorized immigrant when the driver tried to run over the agents, and one of them fired. Minnesota investigators had begun to work on the case of Ms. Good's shooting in collaboration with federal investigators. But that process halted, according to the state's Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which said the FBI would take over the investigation and that the BCA would lose access it needed to investigate the incident. Federal officers generally have immunity against state prosecution for actions taken during their official duty. Around 2,000 federal agents have deployed in Minneapolis in what administration officials say is their largest operation so far. As in other cities, they have faced protesters opposed both to the immigration policies of President Donald Trump and to how ICE operates. Agents have used unmarked vehicles to track and snatch immigrants off the streets across the country, including foreign students. ICE-led operations and protests against them have raised tensions in other cities. Administration officials say activists have impeded law enforcement and endangered themselves and agents in the field, such as by blocking building entrances. Questions on use of force. For months, questions have swirled around ICE policy on the use of force, both in making arrests and confronting protesters. Under federal policy, officers must only use deadly force when they believe it would stop an imminent threat of death or serious injury to the officer or other people, says Udi Ofer, a Princeton professor of public affairs, who worked with the Biden administration. Mr. Ofer helped to draft the Justice Department policy on when federal officers can shoot at a moving vehicle. All federal agencies were required in 2022 to adopt guidelines that match or exceed the DOJ standards, says Professor Ofer via email. The policy makes clear that firearms may not be discharged to disable moving vehicles unless there is a threat of death or serious physical injury to the officer and no other reasonable means of defense exists, he wrote. This includes an officer moving out of the way of the vehicle so as to avoid being injured. The policy also directs federal officers not to shoot to stop a moving vehicle, a practice that has been largely banned by many police departments. The Department of Homeland Security, which oversees ICE, also directs officials not to use deadly force, quote, solely to prevent the escape of a fleeing subject, end quote, in its policy on use of force, dated from 2023. ICE continues to use that policy, said Tricia McLaughlin, an Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security, in a statement. ICE law enforcement officers are trained to use the minimum amount of force necessary to resolve dangerous situations, to prioritize the safety of the public and our officers, she said. Officers are highly trained in de-escalation tactics and regularly receive ongoing use of force training. Mr. Trump claimed on Wednesday that Ms. Good ran him over, referring to the ICE officer, and that made the shooting an act of self-defense. DHS Secretary Kristi Noem repeated this claim on Thursday, as did Vice President J.D. Vance, who said that Ms. Good had been brainwashed and referred to protests as terrorism. This vehicle was used to hit this officer, Ms. Noem said at a news conference. It was used as a weapon, and the officer feels as though his life was in jeopardy. It was used to perpetuate a violent act, and this officer took action to protect himself and to protect his fellow law enforcement officers. The claim that the ICE officer was run over appears to be at odds with multiple videos posted online. No body camera footage has been released that would show how the situation looked to the officers on the scene. Experts on how such incidents are investigated say that evaluating the lawful use of deadly force depends on what constitutes and imminent threat. Was Ms. Goods driving in her vehicle, posing an imminent threat to this officer who shot and killed her? So asked Jeffrey B. Alpert, a criminologist at the University of South Carolina. If there was an imminent threat, that's reasonable. Then the officer was justified. If there wasn't, the officer wasn't justified. But it's premature to assess without a thorough and transparent investigation, he adds. John Gross, a law professor at the University of Wisconsin, who studies how police officers use force, says the videos appear to show Ms. Good's car partially obstructed the road, but didn't pose any threat to human life. The use of deadly force needs to be reasonable under all the surrounding circumstances. And so, nowhere in the video does it appear that the individual who was shot is a threat to the officers to physically harm them, he says. Moreover, federal policy states that law enforcement officers shouldn't fire on moving vehicles, except under specific circumstances. The policy explicitly says that officers should get out of the path of the vehicle instead of shooting at it. And that's a very practical policy, says Professor Gross. Luis Robles, an attorney in New Mexico, who defends police misconduct cases and trains law enforcement, said he has seen no video that shows the incident from the perspective of the officer who fired his gun. But generally, he said, officers are trained not to stand in front of vehicles. The case law is also consistent with that. Don't create the danger that might require you to shoot your way out. I just want to be safe. In September, an ICE agent fatally shot a Mexican immigrant in Chicago who was accused of using his car as a weapon to impede his detention. Surveillance videos contradicted accounts given by administration officials who said the agent who fired had suffered severe injuries. A month later, a federal agent in Chicago shot a woman who had joined protests against immigration raids. Maramar Martinez was inside her vehicle when she was fired upon and wounded. Federal agents said the protesters had boxed in agents and that officers had been forced to take evasive action. Ms. Martinez was later charged with assault and attempted murder. But the charges were dropped in November amid claims that federal officers had tampered with evidence and that the official account of events had been distorted. A Department of Homeland Security had labeled Ms. Martinez and a co-defendant in the vehicle as domestic terrorists. Immigration agents have faced judicial scrutiny over their operations in Chicago and the handling of mostly nonviolent protests. In November, a federal judge found that the use of force had been excessive and that official accounts of events were misleading and unreliable. Critics of federal immigration enforcement say that officers, who often wear face coverings as a defense against what they say are retaliatory actions, such as doxing, act with apparent immunity. Agents who are involved in on-duty shootings are rarely punished. An investigation by The Trace in 2024 found that 59 such shootings occurred between 2015 and 2021, of which 23 were fatal. No agents were prosecuted over these shootings. Back in Minneapolis, Mohammed Abdi joined Thursday's gathering at the memorial site. A nurse from St. Paul, the nearby Twin City, Mr. Abdi saw the incident as an avoidable tragedy. The officer had time to move, he said. Mr. Abdi from Kenya and of Somali descent, is now an American citizen. Yet amid the immigration enforcement surge here, he carries around his U.S. passport for proof. "I just want to be safe," Mr. Abdi says. "This is a moment to stand with each other," he says. "If it was her yesterday, today it's me. Tomorrow, it's you." And that completes the article. Staff writer Sarah Matusek reported from Minneapolis and Simon Montlake from Boston. Staff writers Caitlin Babcock and Sophie Hills contributed reporting from Washington. The name of the article was "ICE Policy Limits Use of Lethal Force. Minnesota Shooting Tests Those Constraints." The second article is "Venezuelans Wanted Change, but Post-U.S. Strike, They Worry It's More of the Same," by special correspondent Whitney Ulich and special contributor Valentina Gill. For years in Venezuela, almost any time the lights went out, a frequent occurrence, someone was likely to quip that the United States was behind it, preparing to swoop in and take out the president. The oft-repeated wisecrack reflects a century of American intervention in Latin America, as much as a decade of increasing political repression and economic devastation. But what was once a running joke has turned into reality, with a leadership change this past week that, though broadly welcomed, feels increasingly out of their hands. On July 3rd, the large-scale U.S. military strikes knocked out electricity in parts of Venezuela as authoritarian leader Nicolas Maduro was whisked away on questionable legal grounds to face a battery of federal charges on U.S. soil. The news of Mr. Maduro's ouster was met by celebrations among the Venezuelan diaspora from Madrid to Mexico City. The response inside the country was more muted as government repression accelerated following his capture. Even among Mr. Maduro's harshest critics, the sense of initial jubilation has started to sour with fear that Venezuela could face more of the same political repression, shortages of essential goods, human rights abuses, even with Mr. Maduro out of the picture. Vice President and Oil Minister Delcy Rodriguez, part of a powerful faction that made up the Maduro regime, was sworn in as an interim president January 3rd. That transition was dictated by the Venezuelan Constitution, but it surprised many when she was backed by the U.S. president. Donald Trump said in a press conference that Ms. Rodriguez was essentially willing to do what we think is necessary. Ms. Rodriguez, who initially called the U.S. administration extremists who violated international law, changed her position a day after the strikes. Writing on social media January 4th, she declared, "We invite the U.S. government to collaborate with us on an agenda of cooperation." Putting Delcy Rodriguez in charge is just more of the same, says a retired teacher, F.B., who lives in the capital, Caracas. Like others in this story, she is identified by her initials to protect her safety amid escalating government repression. "Ms. Rodriguez played a part in getting our country to where it is today. Venezuela is destroyed." Who should lead the nation? Since Mr. Maduro was first narrowly elected president in 2013, following the death of his charismatic predecessor, Hugo Chavez, a long-divided Venezuelan opposition has come together. It briefly held a majority in the National Assembly in 2015 and boycotted elections it deemed unfair in 2017 and 2020. It declared a separate legitimate president in 2019 who was recognized by the U.S. and other international powers, and led widespread pro-democracy protests in the past decade that were stamped out by violent government repression. In July 2024, Venezuelans overwhelmingly voted in presidential elections for opposition candidate Edmundo González. He was a surrogate for opposition leader Marina Corina Machado, this year's Nobel Peace Prize laureate, who was barred by the government from running. Official vote tallies obtained by the opposition showed Mr. González earning nearly 70% of the ballots. Mr. Maduro clamped down, claimed electoral victory without proof, and began his third consecutive term. Over the past year and a half, many inside the country started to feel Venezuelan's situation would never be resolved without outside military support. But if that happened, many say they expected the rightful winner of the 2024 vote would step in to lead. A tigress. Ms. Rodriguez, who studied labor law in Caracas, grew up in the shadow of the Cold War. Her Marxist guerrilla father was allegedly tortured and killed in the 1970s at the hands of the Venezuelan police. He was arrested for his suspected role in the kidnapping of a U.S. businessman. She sought postgraduate education in Europe and returned to eventually take up public office in Venezuela, fully entrenched in what's known as Chavismo, a political movement named after the late president. She was dubbed a tigress by Mr. Maduro for her unrelenting defense of his government, of which she became vice president in 2018. There's a certain satisfaction with Maduro's detention, but we know this just cut off one of Hydra's heads, says A.V., a young history professor in Caracas. With Ms. Rodriguez, the U.S. and Venezuela will be able to maintain the illusion of following Venezuela's constitution, but in reality, it's just a change in CEO, the arrival of new investors, because the former ones, Cuba, Iran, and Russia, were weakening, he says. In the meantime, the security situation worsens in Venezuela. On Monday, armed civilian gangs loyal to Chavismo set up checkpoints across Caracas, stopping passersby at random to review their phones for photos or messages that might show support for Mr. Maduro's capture, locals say. Analysts say the U.S. might have wanted to find a partner within the existing government apparatus in Venezuela for multiple reasons. Members of Mr. Maduro's regime hold power over the military, intelligence agencies, and the heavily armed paramilitary gangs. Relying on top regime power brokers was recommended to Mr. Trump by the CIA as a way to maintain stability after extricating Mr. Maduro, according to reporting by the Wall Street Journal. Foreign journalists were detained, with many subsequently released in the past week. On Thursday, the president of the National Assembly, Ms. Rodriguez's brother, announced the government would be releasing an important number of political prisoners. Between 800 and 1,000 are behind bars, according to local watchdog groups. What's next? So far, the U.S. has made no public demands on Venezuela to release prisoners or lay off public intimidation and repression. But Trump never said this was about democracy, says David Schmild, a Venezuelan expert at Tulane University. He always just talked about Venezuela as this source of crime, violence, drugs, and immigrants, and also having all these oil resources. The opposition, led by Ms. Machado, also didn't lean into a pro-democracy argument for Mr. Maduro's ouster, because it was clear that this wasn't going to appeal to the Trump administration. It goaded him into taking military action by talking about national security and economic opportunities, Dr. Schmeldy says. But he anticipates the opposition's approach could change in coming weeks, especially now that it's clear its fantasy of leading Venezuela was passed over in favor of Ms. Rodriguez, he says. This transition couldn't have begun without U.S. pulling Maduro out of the country. That's enough for many in the diaspora, says Sylvia Pedraza, a professor at the University of Michigan who has written about the political role of the Venezuelan diaspora. Finally, it's all over, says Sergio Rodriguez, who fled Venezuela in 2017 and now works for a private car service in Miami. It's a feeling that things are going to get better and that our people will get the country we deserve, he says by telephone Monday. For those inside Venezuela, the situation feels far from over. It's those left inside Venezuela who we should now be listening to, because they've suffered the most, says Dr. Pedraza. And that completes the article. The authors Whitney Ulich reported this story from Mexico City and Valentina Gill from Caracas. And their article was titled, Venezuelans Wanted Change, but Post-U.S. Strike, They Worry, is More of the Same. I'm going to take just a brief moment out of the broadcast to remind those of you who may have tuned in late, this is the Christian Science Monitor Daily Program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading from the Friday, January 9th, 2026 issue of the Monitor. The title of the next article, How Far Can Trump Push Might Makes Right? By columnist Ned Temko. Might makes right. That, delivered with a deliberate swagger, was the message President Donald Trump sent with the audacious weekend abduction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. It was intended not just for America's hemispheric neighbors. Friend and foe alike, around the globe, were also meant to take note. Mr. Trump made that explicit after the Venezuela raid, by reviving efforts to wrest ownership of the Arctic territory of Greenland from a European NATO ally, Denmark. Yet a critical question remains in Venezuela, Greenland, and other priority foreign policy arenas. Will Mr. Trump, even if he is ready to deploy U.S. military might, prove able to bend other countries to America's will? Coming almost 12 weeks since his return to the White House, the attack in Caracas served as an exclamation point to Mr. Trump's redefinition of the United States' place on the world stage. Gone is a decades-old U.S. commitment, under presidents from both political parties, to a rules-based international order managed through organizations and alliances, above all NATO, that Washington has built and led since the Second World War. Now the focus is on America First priorities, secured unilaterally by U.S. economic, political, and military power. There has been a value shift as well, away from a declared preference for democratic rule, human rights, and international law. Now, value appears to be measured in dollars and cents, business opportunities, and control over resources. Oil in Venezuela, or in Greenland, untapped deposits of rare earth elements, critical for military and other high-tech manufacturing. The Venezuela attack put that new vision into action. Shrugging off previous administrations' habits of laying diplomatic groundwork for military action, Mr. Trump ordered a raid that showcased U.S. strengths in intelligence, planning, and pinpoint execution, impervious to accusations that it violated international law. Nor was the president visibly bothered about ensuring an end to Mr. Maduro's brutally authoritarian rule. Mr. Trump dismissed the prospect of helping install a new government under Maria Corina Machado, the opposition leader and Nobel Peace Laureate, whose chosen candidate, Edmundo González Urrutia, won a landslide victory in Venezuela's 2024 presidential election. At least until a proper transition could be achieved, he said America would run the country, working, he hoped, through the deposed Mr. Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez. His main focus was clearly on Venezuela's oil potential, which he expects U.S. companies to revive and expand. But the attack also underscored the limitations to might is right unilateralism and raised the unanswered question of whether President Trump can succeed in persuading other countries to fall in line with his policy agenda. In Venezuela, with a democratic transition on the back burner, he might get what he wants. Though industry experts say a U.S.-led oil renaissance is unlikely in the near term, Mr. Trump said this week that $2 billion worth of Venezuelan oil, stored and stockpiled as a result of U.S. sanctions, would soon be on its way to American refineries. Still, if the newly elevated President Rodriguez does not do Washington's bidding, what does Mr. Trump have left in his toolbox? The administration has cultivated an image of renewed American military power, epitomized by Mr. Trump's decision to rebrand the Department of Defense as the Department of War. But he has limited its deployment to a series of sharp, short demonstrations of muscle. Last year's bunker-busting bomb attack on Iranian nuclear facilities, a series of attacks against suspected narcotics smugglers off the Venezuelan coast and in the Pacific or Eastern Pacific, and the smash-and-grab raid in Caracas. The president has shown no appetite for the kind of larger-scale action needed to make good on his claim to have obliterated Tehran's nuclear program, nor for the kind of sustained U.S. military commitment that would be required if Ms. Rodriguez or Maduro loyalists in Venezuela's army ignore U.S. orders. And Greenland? Mr. Trump would presumably prefer to secure control of the island and its roughly 60,000 inhabitants through political and economic means, with the White House suggested buying Greenland, something both the territory and Denmark have ruled out. Yet officials also said this week that the president had not taken the military option off the table. This is a war that on paper would be almost impossible to lose. The U.S. already has a military base there. In agreement with Denmark, Washington based as many as 10,000 troops in Greenland during the Cold War, and the Danish and Greenland governments would likely be open to a renewed strengthening of the U.S. presence. But not by force. European NATO leaders, including Trump-friendly Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, this week rejected the idea of a U.S. takeover. Unilateral U.S. action, Denmark's Prime Minister said, would signal the end of the transatlantic alliance. Its core Article 5 commitment to mutual defense in the case of an attack on any member was framed with Soviet Russia in mind. It would become a mockery if the aggressor was NATO's own most powerful nation. Is the collapse of America's most important post-war alliance a price Mr. Trump would be willing to pay? Perhaps, but the question suggests the need for a postscript to the might is right message from Caracas. Might, by itself, may not always prove as valuable as it appears. That finishes the article. The title, How Far Can Trump Push Might Makes Right? Written by columnist Ned Temko. The next title is, In War Powers Vote on Venezuela, Senate Offers Rare Rebuke of Trump, by staff writers Simon Montlake and Caitlin Babcock. A resolution requiring congressional approval for future military operations in Venezuela narrowly passed a key Senate test vote on Thursday, just 5 days after President Donald Trump sent forces to capture and depose President Nicolas Maduro, without first informing Congress. Five Republicans joined all Democrats in voting for the measure, marking a significant rebuke of the administration. The resolution, sponsored by Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, was the Senate's second attempt to restrain the Trump administration in confronting Venezuela, including airstrikes on alleged drug boats. It now heads to a final vote, expected next week. A similar resolution was rejected by the House last month. House Democrats reintroduced that measure on Thursday. The vote remains essentially symbolic, as President Trump has already vowed to veto the measure should it reach his desk. While some GOP lawmakers have expressed concerns about the administration's Venezuelan policy, and many roundly rejected the idea that the United States should seize Greenland, Thursday's vote largely fell along partisan lines. Still, the Senate's action hinted at new pushback from the GOP-controlled legislative branch, which has so far largely green-lit Mr. Trump's expansive presidency. Republicans have shied away from confronting Mr. Trump, even when Congress's power of the purse has been breached, while Democrats have limited avenue for recourse. But this week, the House, where Republicans' already slim majority has narrowed since the departure of former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene and the death of Representative Doug LaMalfa, advanced a Democratic measure to extend health insurance subsidies after some centrist Republicans joined with Democrats in signing a discharge petition to force a vote. The measure passed the House Thursday, with support from 17 Republicans. The House also voted Thursday on overriding a veto from President Trump on a Colorado water bill that had passed both chambers unanimously. That measure failed to achieve the necessary two-thirds majority, but won support from 35 Republicans. Mr. Trump responded to Thursday's War Powers vote with a scathing statement on social media, saying the five GOP senators who voted with Democrats should never be elected to office again. The president contended that the move would hamper national security. Congress's wariness over checking an administration's military actions predates Mr. Trump. Past administrations, both Democratic and Republican, have used force without checking with lawmakers, says Sarah Burns, a political scientist at the Rochester Institute of Technology and expert on the 1973 War Powers Resolution. That act has become the go-to for lawmakers seeking to restrain administrations. It was the basis for Senator Kaine's resolution, and for Democrats more broadly to criticize the Trump administration for failing to consult Congress in advance of the January 1 military operation in Venezuela. Many Republicans argue that the War Powers Act is not applicable in this case. This is not a war. This is a law enforcement operation to arrest somebody pursuant to a warrant issued by federal court, says Senator John Cornyn from Texas, referring to charges faced by Mr. Maduro for alleged drug trafficking. The deposed leader pleaded not guilty Tuesday in a New York court. John Kennedy, a GOP senator from Louisiana, characterized Thursday's resolution as an overreach. I have great respect for Tim Kaine, but I think it's an effort to throw a wrench in the administration's plans for arresting criminals in South America, he says. Democrats say Congress should be involved in the exercise of U.S. military power around the world, and that Thursday's vote was an important step toward reclaiming that role. It would tell the president he can't just go invade any country he feels like without congressional authorization, says Senator Mazie Hirono of Hawaii. Under Article 1 of the Constitution, Congress has the power to declare war and to raise and support armies. But that language reflects the war-making statecraft of the 18th century, when rulers had to levy taxes to raise armies, and warfare was largely state-based. Since then, the U.S. has used military force overseas on hundreds of occasions, but only declared war 5 times, according to John Yoo, a conservative legal scholar who served in the second Bush administration. The record of American military conflicts is notable for the absence, not the presence, of declarations of war by Congress, he writes. Congress has the power of appropriations to determine military deployments, but often shies away from actually using it, says Professor Burns. What we need instead is legislators going on talk shows, writing memos and pieces in newspapers saying the president has overstepped his bounds, rather than asserting their powers to reassert themselves into the realm of foreign policy and in the realm of war, she says. Senator Ruben Gallego, a Democrat from Arizona, has proposed an amendment to a defense appropriations bill related to the use of force in Greenland, an autonomous region ruled by Denmark, a NATO ally. It would prevent funds from being used to prepare for or carry out military operations in Greenland. The last time Congress made a comprehensive attempt at limiting the president's war powers was in 2021. A bipartisan group of senators, Republican Mike Lee of Utah, Independent Bernie Sanders of Vermont, and Democrat Chris Murphy of Connecticut, authorized a bill that would have required administrations to seek explicit approval from Congress for all military operations. The bill would have also automatically cut off funding when its standards weren't met. It failed to pass. And that completes the article. The title was In War Powers Vote on Venezuela, Senate Offers Rare Rebuke of Trump, by staff writers Simon Montlake and Caitlin Babcock. The next article is titled Rural Homelessness is on the Rise. Volunteers are rallying to meet the moment, by staff writer Scott Baldoff. 2 years ago, Casey Tobias, started to notice a phenomenon at the Sunoco station where she worked. Customers were struggling. At the end of the month, they were paying for gasoline with pocket change, the last money they had. The COVID-19 pandemic was receding, and hundreds of people were losing jobs in the local RV manufacturing industry. Ms. Tobias started cooking big meals to bring to work. If she saw a customer who looked hungry, she would send them to her truck, where the food sat in carry-out boxes. In time, Ms. Tobias left her job to found a nonprofit organization, Homeless Outreach Practiced Every Day, or HOPE. Recently, HOPE took over an abandoned thrift store called the County Closet, where Ms. Tobias and a team of volunteers distribute donated clothing and other items to the most vulnerable people in Three Rivers, Michigan. Ms. Tobias says she understands the stress that many homeless people feel. Last October, her doctor told her that she had a serious illness and needed treatment right away. She had just $3,000 in savings. "This is what people are facing all across the nation," Ms. Tobias says. "They are just one disaster away from losing everything. One disaster." Across the heartland, rural homelessness has been growing sharply over the past 5 years. The product of failed businesses, stagnant wages, rising inflation, and shrinking housing supply. Many homeless people in rural areas couch surf at the homes of friends or family members who themselves might be struggling to make ends meet. But as tent encampments grow in rural areas, small town volunteers are responding the best way they know how, with food, coats, and encouragement. What we see in rural communities is deep family ties and friends and faith organizations, and they have no choice but to uphold their duty to take care of each other, says Mary Kinnean, the Chief Equity Officer of the National Alliance to End Homelessness, an advocacy group in Washington. In theory, federal and state governments have created networks of service providers called continuums of care to meet the needs of rural people who live in places where affordable housing or skills training programs don't exist. But Ms. Kinnean says these programs are grossly underfunded after years of disinvestment. Rural communities have a strong capacity and will do more with less, Ms. Kinnean says. People in rural communities deserve the same resources that we see in urban communities, but instead they end up having to deal with the leftovers and to make that stretch. At last count, 126,288 people were experiencing homelessness in rural areas of America, according to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's 2024 point-in-time count data. Rural homelessness increased by 12% between 2023 and 2024, the result of rising food and housing costs and stagnant wages, says Jonathan Harwitz, Director of Policy at the Housing Assistance Council, which studies rural homelessness. COVID-era relief packages that provided stipends and rental assistance were a big help, Mr. Horwitz says. But when those relief packages expired, small towns and volunteer networks had to pool whatever resources they had to help those in need. From homelessness to helping out. In Three Rivers, Tiffany Schweitzer says she had been living on the streets for several months, sometimes sleeping in the back of cars, but more often under the open sky. With winter fast approaching, Ms. Schweitzer needed warmer clothes and a place to stay. She found her way to the county closet, and Ms. Tobias pointed her toward some brand new coats, recent arrivals from a clothing drive. She could tell I was struggling, and it was getting worse, Ms. Schweitzer says in a phone interview. It was a blessing in a time of need. I was wanting to change my life around. She inspired me to do better with my life. From that first encounter that started with a warm jacket, Ms. Schweitzer says she has now become a HOPE volunteer herself to help friends who are still out on the streets. She recently started volunteering at the county closet. HOPE, in turn, sponsored Ms. Schweitzer's stay at a rehabilitation center for 90 days, where she hoped to learn how to control her addictions. Local workers who have lived experiences of homelessness can be incredibly helpful because they know or can identify who else is also vulnerable, says Su-Ta Su, an associate professor of social work, data science, and society at the University of North Carolina. Besides providing emergency services such as food, volunteers can also connect the most vulnerable with other services, such as health and transportation and shelter. In some places, however, the influx of newly arrived people can be so great that simply providing food can exhaust a community's capacity to respond. In Kalamazoo, about a 35-minute drive north of Three Rivers, volunteers from Kalamazoo Together for the Unhoused gather supplies for the growing number of homeless people coming into the city for relief. By day, team members collect donations of season-appropriate clothing, wool blankets, drinks, and food. At night, Judy Lowry and a few volunteers, some of whom are homeless themselves, drive to local encampments in Kalamazoo and to surrounding rural areas. On an average night, the group feeds 80 people. The strain on small communities. In Battle Creek, about 25 miles east of Kalamazoo, the small network of service providers and shelters for homeless people that had grown over the years was rapidly overwhelmed by the COVID-19 pandemic. Many of the new arrivals now came from rural areas, says Kathy Antaya, a volunteer coordinator for the SHARE Center, a nonprofit that cares for vulnerable seniors, veterans, families, and individuals experiencing homelessness. We have seen a huge influx in people from other communities, says Ms. Antaya, who has volunteered at the center for 7 years. We heard a rumor that a soup kitchen shut down in a town outside of Battle Creek. That afternoon, a bus pulled up, and a bunch of people with backpacks showed up. They told us they were put on a bus and told, "Here's a place that can feed you. Good luck." Ms. Antaya says organizations such as the SHARE Center are doing what they can to meet the need, but they're struggling. "I think we just don't realize how many unhoused people we have in our rural communities," she says. "When people in a small community fall on hard times, that puts stress on the small community and its ability to support the unhoused." And that completes the article. Rural homelessness is on the rise. Volunteers are rallying to meet the moment. I'm going to close with the Monitor's view by the Monitor's editorial staff. Crowdsourcing the awe of nature. "We can never have enough of nature," New England writer and naturalist Henry David Thoreau declared in his 1854 work, Walden, or Life in the Woods. Given the accelerating discovery of species in recent years, humans are likely to keep having more of nature than Thoreau may have ever imagined. A lot more. "We're finding new species at a faster rate than ever before," according to Professor John Weens, author of a recently published University of Arizona-led study. Between just 2015 and 2020, the study documented an average of more than 16,000 new species identified each year. The soaring pace is cause for celebration among the professionals who study insects, amphibians, animals, and even among those who search for new objects in outer space. It is also a tip of the hat to the millions of amateur citizen scientists expanding the world's knowledge and appreciation of nature. New and easy-to-use technology, such as AI, is helping to tap into and amplify human awe over natural wonders, both little and large. For instance, photos from a citizen science helped Australian researchers identify an entirely new genus, one classification level above species of praying mantises in 2023. On the interstellar scale, amateurs scanning mountains of data from NASA's Kepler Space Telescope discovered a system of exoplanets outside Earth's solar system. A multitude of apps are helping us to democratize science, biology professor Michael Friedman told the site Inside Climate News. They are an equalizer, he said, giving even those without a college degree the ability to do science that's publishable in academic journals. Users of software such as Merlin for birds or the more general iNaturalist can upload sound recordings or images that were initially sorted by AI systems. Data from iNaturalist, with an estimated 3 million users, has reportedly been used in more than 4,000 scientific papers. The state of California is partnering with the site to incorporate the data into decision-making tools for conservation. And perhaps even more important, one might add, is that the same digital technologies driving social isolation and cyberbullying are also demonstrating their positive potential to reinvigorate interpersonal connections. And with that, we have run out of time. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor Daily, the Friday, January 9th, 2026 edition, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I hope you enjoyed the program. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and thank you so much for joining me today.